All right, so between me and cookies is 5 questions. Okay, so I'm just gonna ask 5 questions. I'm gonna try and figure out the answer, discuss it. I was told to try and be provocative, but I'm a nice person, so we'll try. Okay, the first question, okay, is how black are these merging black holes? There are all these bright theorists in the room, right? And these poor observers have to write all these telescope proposals and stand up in front of serious tax and convince them to give us telescope time to do all of this EM effort. I don't know if you guys saw the papers on the OVAN effort. There's something like 80 telescopes that are following up binary black hole mergers. Little ones, big ones, medium-sized ones, every single wavelength. And we have to stand up in front of these stacks and put up a story, okay? So if you're to follow up merging black holes going forward in O2, in O1 we could all pledge ignorance. We had no idea. LIGO didn't tell us what we were following up, so we were operating under ignorance. That was our excuse to the serious stack member, okay? But going forward, that's not an excuse. We will know at the time of trigger whether something is a binary black hole or not. And is there any reason for us to follow up binary black holes? I know Marcel was saying that she's going to do one of them, right, in O2. The one best one, I don't know, define best. What did you tell the TAC to let you do the one best one?
So our story for the TAC
So the story there that we told the tech was that we would follow up. Well, we were asking for time for 2 events, one binary black hole event and one with a neutron star in it. And in the case for black holes, the idea was to be able to put limits on the existence of counterparts to a, in case there is an unexpected or unpredicted counterpart, we would be able to see it. And in case if it's not there, we would be able to put limits on those models. But we were purposely not very clear there on what would constitute the good event or what type of models would that try to exclude.
Okay, so what models? What would, okay, suppose we're able to put a 27th magnitude upper limit on, you know, a minute after or seconds after the merger, that there is no optical or infrared counterpart within minutes and 2 ridiculous limits. I can't think deeper than 27. That's as deep as I think Hubble can go. What does it mean to the theorist? Lars, what does it mean to you?
Well, I think it's, I mean, you have to, okay, I'll say the obvious things first. I mean, you obviously have to look for a while until you either get exhausted or the tax kick you off, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in terms of a valid hypothesis, I mean, I don't know of any hypothesis that is in the sense where a negative result will actually have any meaning. So there's not a secure prediction.
Oh, so right? Even the free neutron decay or the lanthanides forming?
No, merging black holes.
Oh, okay.
Right,
yeah.
So I think...
There are stories for the other ones, right?
Yeah, but I'm just saying for merging black holes, I don't know of any hypothesis that I would say an upper limit would have any scientific meaning. So you look, and hopefully you discover something beautiful, of course.
So let me ask the question the other way, okay? I mean,
that's my answer. You should ask others.
Okay, let's stick to this, then ask a few other theorists. Stoll.
Well, as you know, I have a paper in process explaining how you get electromagnetic counterparts of merging black holes. There are many, it's my opinion, so much less plausible proposals for doing that. As Lars says, I think if you don't see anything, that's fine. It's not going to rule anything out particularly, but if you discover something, it'll be wonderful, right?
So let's take your model, right? I mean, that
my model is not going to produce 27th magnitude. No.
Right.
Keep going.
Okay. Okay.
It's 10 megaparsecs away, maybe.
Okay. So But is that prompt emission, or is, I mean, there are some models that at least have been proposed for prompt emission, right? But is there any? Within a half hour, but not hours or days or weeks. I mean, okay, so within half hour or X-ray or UV, and I think we have right now zero capability in that regard, right? I mean,
well, I think that all the upper limits have this, you know, beautiful meaning that we always attribute to all the fundamental physics tests, like if you want to measure if you know what is the if the gravitational force goes like 1 over r squared or r over 2 plus epsilon, and you measure that this epsilon is smaller and smaller and smaller, the bounds on the epsilon are smaller and smaller, and if we don't find anything, we just we're doing something like this beautiful fundamental physics test, and this is the value that we should be aiming for.
Okay.
What's the prediction you're talking about?
So imagine from 10 years from now you have dozens of neutron stars. And then you have dozens of black hole merging systems with upper limits, which are more stringent than neutron star detection. That's an interesting, not surprising, but interesting concern.
Yeah. And then at that point, whether you continue to search, deep search.
So the analogy for what Elliot just said, in fact, has been done in the stellar black hole world. Type 1 bursts are seen in certain kinds of X-ray systems, but in other kinds of systems called X-ray NOVA, no type 1 bursts have ever been seen, which shows black holes have no surfaces. You know, that evolved over time without any proposal to tag. I think if I could paraphrase what Mansi's question is, what sort of BS can an observer write that looks plausible to get the observing time in the first place?
Yeah, because I think TACs are getting increased. And this is coming from the director of Caltech Optical Observatories. So I think he has a pretty good understanding about how skeptical the TACs are getting. So, okay, let me ask a different question. Okay, so let me just end this part of the discussion by saying, okay, if we follow up these binary black holes, right, if the TACs are kind enough, give us the time, and we find the exotic transients in them, okay, how many theorists in the room will come up with a model to explain it?
How many theorists are there in the room?
It's a 7-sigma detection of something that is phenomenologically distinct from anything else that we know.
Then it gets interesting. If it's
then
like,
you'll write a paper, Elliot.
I would start to think seriously about it.
Because we saw Fermi with a 3, right? So there is okay. On that positive note, let's move on to situations where there's more light, right? So we've heard plenty of talks now that there are two classes of models. So we're going to break up the next few questions on these two classes. So there's again, from an astronomer's perspective, there's blue fast light and then there's slow red light. Okay, so let's talk about each of these scenarios a little bit more and ask some specific questions. So on this blue fast light, right, I mean, the question that I have in my mind is that if escaping free neutrons is really our only hope, then do we believe this actually happens? So the model I'm referring to is Brian Metzger's model, where if 2% of the free neutrons escape, then you'll see a very, very fast fading bright blue counterpart. And we are perfectly equipped to find and identify this counterpart unambiguously. And in this particular model, let me just show you Brian's models here. These are predictions for different values, for different parameters in ejector mass and opacity. The blue and red are G-band and R-band, so just different filters. And I've just made a line on 21st magnitude and 1 day there. So you can see that to a very, very attainable depth, By surveys today, we can constrain this model. If you don't find anything, this is a really meaningful upper limit. Okay? So this is a very important model, except that there's only one paper on this model, well, maybe two. I mean, there was in Sri's unpublished paper on archive as well, there's some mention of free neutrons escaping. But why is there only one paper on this model? Do theorists believe this is, in fact, a credible model, that 2% of free neutrons will escape and beta decay, and they will be completely unimpacted and unaffected by Chris's opacities and, other things?
So I see you can have free neutrons, right? We have them all the time. What it's in anybody's network. They have the number of free neutrons afterwards. Those free neutrons decay into hydrogen. That's fine. So you get all that. Mm-hmm. What is the how and anything that heats up, you can get blue just by you're heating up something where the opacities haven't when it's enough ionized that you don't see the opacities. What is it special about the neutrons and their energy injection? So I haven't read the paper. So
I think the idea was it's this shock heated envelope of the neutrons.
You eject some very fast surface layers that.
Right.
It's the time scale. You eject.
And speed.
He's avoiding. He's doing the fast decompression.
That's right.
And the argument was that in these simulations they see material. That 2% accelerated the density gradient in an SPH calculation, but which is, the simulations are not very clear, but if you're going to have any energy, it could be possible that you have a velocity distribution, no? But I think it's very speculative.
And I think you avoid the opacity issue just because it's the very fast moving stuff in front that has the free neutron.
So you don't need neutron, you just need to have something that because they have a short decay time, why neutrons versus anything that's radioactive decaying at that hour?
It's a very fast expansion time, mm-hmm. So the stuff decompresses very rapidly.
You produce a second beta.
No, except the opacity issue. I think that's what Chris is. You do have in the normal story, you have lots of stuff decaying on an hour time scale. I'm not sure.
Okay, so what about these?
It's important to say that the ejector properties that motivated this, I think, are somewhat uncertain.
So what about this model is uncertain? That's what I'd like to understand. Why the use of the word speculative?
Ended up being 0.2%, in which case all your magnitudes come down by 2, and it's unobservable, right?
So is there any way to constrain this fraction?
I think the merger simulations will...
Much higher resolutions.
That's right.
So much higher resolution.
Isn't the difficulty that really this layer comes from the sharp edges, which SPH cannot accommodate?
Yeah, and that's not SPH, that's why I say better simulation.
Okay.
In the Greek codes, people are doing mergers inside a white core.
Mm-hmm.
Because the background is very high. So it's very, very difficult to get a handle on the very small, amount of.
Yeah, so his comment is that the vacuum density for the gray code calculations is essentially the white dwarf densities. So that actually means the mergers are happening inside the white dwarf. And so they aren't going to produce very good accurate numbers there.
Okay, but how do we make progress on this question, right? I mean, that's the key point
right.
here.
So
right?
when will a simulation first actually shed light on this?
Is anybody working on this?
Are we talking 1 year? Are we talking a decade?
Well, I think it's a good to your basic point is this is the most, you think this is the most observable thing that's actually
been created. By far.
So you really want the theorists to focus on
it. Okay, If you just look at the list of telescopes that are following up gravitational wave triggers, majority of them are optical telescopes. Majority of them are small optical telescopes. And something like a limit of 21st mag and less than 1 day, that I think is very, very doable. Because if you look at this light curve, and there are three things. This is actually not an easy light curve to constrain, right? Because the x-axis here is not days. The x-axis here is hours. So this thing fades away in less than a day, But that doesn't scare me at all, because the speed, right? I mean, this is a hard problem, because all you need is speed. But the speed is something that astronomers, time domain astronomers, have been working very, very hard on, right? And there are three things to the speed here, right? One is T0. How quickly after T0 do you respond? In O1, it was very slow. I mean, we didn't even know for like 2 days after the trigger. That's when the astronomers were alerted.
But that's not for any scientific reasons, right?
Right.
That can be done.
But now that the beautiful announcements are out and we are in the gravitational wave era, right? The era has begun. I think the time lag also means that people will be less stressed and we'll get the trigger within minutes as the code produces, as opposed to when people are okay with it. So I think the speed of response will get addressed. Right? But the speed of response is related to one more thing, right? Which is, where in the world are you? In the two detector network, the location of your observatory determines the speed of your response. Because if you're located in either Chile or in Russia, then you have to wait for the Earth to rotate. So you have to intrinsically wait for about 12 hours on average before you can respond to a trigger, before the thing comes above you. But it doesn't matter. There are plenty of telescopes, at least in North America, and maybe some floating on ships in the Indian Ocean. I'm kidding. In South Africa or in Australia, that speed of response is not a problem. We can respond in principle within minutes after the outburst. The second component of speed is, how quickly can you filter down the list of candidates to identify the handful that are interesting and do follow up in time, right? And that's also something I think that, you know, with PTF and Tree's presentation, he presented Leo Singer's PhD thesis work, which is, how do you reduce, you know, thousands of candidates to a handful and go around the globe and follow things up. All of this stuff we can do, right? But the question remains that you have the speed of response, you have the speed at which your software can filter out candidates and identify interesting transients, you have the speed of follow-up, in which you can make friends with people around the world and not be limited by the Earth's rotation and actually get spectra and photometry in time. That's all things we have actually proven we can do. So, but we're completely dependent on whether these 2% of free neutrons escape or not. Because the lanthanides radioactively decaying, that's a very tough problem. And we'll come to that for the third question. But right now I want to focus on the fast fading blue emission. Right? I mean, how real is this fast fading blue emission?
So, Mansi, if I'm interpreting the responses correctly, it sounds like doing the quick thing that Brian and collaborators did with the SPH codes is easy. Doing this properly requires doing fully gridded simulations, which is going to take longer with full neutron star neutron star simulations to get the shock shell coming out.
There are other Lagrangian techniques that are significantly better than SPA. So one could use an alternative moving mesh tech code to do this calculation. That's an interesting problem.
I mean,
so you might submit the stuff that's called ejected. Where was it ejected from?
It's thin shock outer layer of fusion. It's essentially shock breakdown.
So shock breakout have very good analytic treatments.
And they appeal to some of that.
Okay.
I don't think they did it super detailed.
Yeah, I mean, you can do it analytically. You know, if you know the density structure more or less, and you produce a shock, you will get a velocity distribution. No, I mean, in the particular cases that they were advocating, they were seeing some of this material also being ejected out of the outer Lagrangian points, and that was concerning to me, because of course the local escape velocity there was not 0.9 c or something like that they were claiming. So that clearly was artificially, you know, enhancing the simulations. But if you heat up the outer layers of the material and then you get, you know, a shock propagating outwards, you're going to get some velocity distribution there.
Okay.
But the question is that you really have to understand the thermodynamics of that to really follow the thermodynamical trajectories with a nuclear network and see what you get, which was not done.
So Chris, is this something you can do?
So I mean, this is, you can do this, and then in fact you see it in a lot of lectures. If you see this blue thing in the first, you know, 12 hours, 18 hours, that is that's heated material. You're seeing, I usually call it, you know, it's the shock breakout, shock emergence of the lecture. So I mean, you can definitely, you have that. You're wanting to look at it
fuzzy in the first, 12 hours. But you'll see that lots of people going through this thing.
Okay.
But how do you tell the difference between the shock, shock heated versus radioactive heated? I don't know. I mean, we have that rope in the room already in supernova.
Well, here the size of the object is very, very small. When you want it's fast decompression, you have a layer.
But if you have something that's fast catching up with something that's slow, you're going to continue to get shocked to your brain.
So I had a question actually for when you do the nuclear astrophysics. So let's say I have a certain amount of neutron star material, so I know the Fermi energy at this point. I want to know, is this problem solved? Can it be modeled? I can change the density arbitrarily. That's my free parameter, which is the rate of change of density. At what rate of change of density will I actually get free neutrons?
Yeah, so go look at the neutron-driven wind community. That's what they did. So you do a nuclear network. So Stan and I did the first time I saw lots of free neutrons was Stan and I did a collapse from a neutron star down to a quark star, and then we had ejecta. And in all of that ejecta, we ended up with most of the stuff coming out as free neutrons and then decaying down to protons. So it's in everybody's network. When someone does a network calculation.
So if it is in the network, why don't we actually see this? I mean, if it's significant in the case of supernovae, why don't we actually see a blue bump? I mean, is it just confused with the shock breakout bump?
No.
I mean, or is it just not bright enough?
It's not typical supernovae.
I mean, you always get a little bit.
Oh, 10 to the minus 7 solar mass. Okay.
Yeah, and you always get a little bit in most neutrino-driven winds, some free neutrons. But it's okay. Small enough that it's not going to play a role in anything.
But the code exists to do this for the neutron star merger case then?
So anybody that's in a post-process of any ejecta, they will have a free neutron fraction in
them. If you have the right thermal angle ejector,
yeah.
Then it's easy to do.
You know how much mass, how fast it's going, what its starting density is, that you can answer the question.
I mean, one thing I don't know is that these models, there's
a lot of uncertain nuclear physics that goes into these calculations, so there's different parameterizations of how to model that, and I have no idea whether the free neutron fraction is particularly sensitive to that. Do you know that, Chris?
That was my question.
Yeah, I don't.
Okay, I'll give you whatever rho by dt, I'll
yeah.
Whatever you want, but you have to assure me your code is actually
right. So that I don't know whether the free neutron fraction is sensitive to some of these details. That's a calculable question.
No, but I don't want those other guys. I really want a high fraction of free neutrons. So there are two parts, it seems to me. One is we don't know if this nucleus stuff itself is high fidelity, let alone any SPH business.
Do the neutrons actually really matter, or is the material that's going at these high speeds and so far, how does it so optically thin that even if it was heavier stuff, it wouldn't matter, right? As long as you have the decay time is less than a few hours, it's still heating. And the real question is whether the column density is so small, it doesn't really matter what the opacity is anymore.
Yeah, you need enough column density to bring it down from whatever decay energy it is to the optical. But that's what I was saying, I was thinking at least. Do I care if it's neutrons or does it really matter? It's just, do I have this thin layer? And that's where you see a lot of people when they run these, they have a blue shock breakout simply because that thin layer on top, that's what that's
so,
your blue.
So how much mass is in that thin layer in current models, current kilonova models?
Well, then it's how well are we resolving our photosphere?
Oh, you're back to resolution.
So that's in the light curve people's arena of do they really resolve their photosphere or not?
Not be free neutrons, because you could get stuff that has a somewhat longer decay time scale that's more comparable to the peak of the light curve. You'd be more efficient at getting energy out.
So what are the typical half-lives of some of the heavy elements that are synthesized? Yeah.
Broad distribution. That's why you get kind of power law. Because the
But it goes all the way from minutes, hours to days. Okay. Okay. Okay, I mean, other ways by which you can make blue emission, I mean, one is the lifetime of the hypermassive neutron star. If that's long enough, then in this paper by Dan Kaysen, he shows different lifetimes of the hypermassive neutron star. And you can see you get a little bit more blue emission if it, if you're up to 100 milliseconds there. So any comments on that? I mean, on this, on the lifetime of the hypermassive neutron star before it collapses to form a black hole?
Well, this is basically a neutrino driven wave with different light.
Yes, it's the neutrinos from the neutron star changing the composition of the stuff, exactly. So I think probably the answer is that either the hypermassive neutron star collapses so quickly that it's not very important, or it lives for more or less ever. Because it's the time scale, you know.
So it doesn't ever collapse to form.
Yeah, I mean, depending on the maximum mass of the neutron star, we could definitely have mergers where the neutron star lives.
I thought in this model, after 100 milliseconds, it eventually collapses, right?
That's they're appealing to differential rotation to hold up, to increase the Chandrasekhar mass, and then they have some time scale on which you redistribute angular momentum and allow it to collapse. But in principle, there could be sources where, depending on the mass of the incoming neutron stars and the maximum mass, you could have an infinitely long-lived.
Mm-hmm. I think that's the green line here. This T inf R. Okay.
So for the people who model binary neutron star systems, what is the lowest total mass you think is plausible? I mean, there's...
sort of respectable measurements of neutron stars with masses of 2.4, depending on what you do with the center of light, right? There's a range, maybe.
2.4. Nothing between 2.5 and 2.3.
Oh, no, there are plenty of 2. It depends how shaky you want to get.
It's worth actually revisiting that, since that's not such an important question. I mean, the problem there is that with these black widow systems, you know, you're measuring the velocity, which is a little bit more than simply the velocity of the companion star. But if we can settle that issue for 1957, if we can show it is 2.4, well, I think that would change a lot of thinking here. It's worth re-examining.
There's several more besides 1957.
Yeah, well, that's the one I know because I worked on it. That's all I remember. But that's probably worth a whole effort on the same scale as this SPH business. I mean, probably it's more doable than anything else so far we discussed.
Okay, and then the third piece of blue emission hope is the relative ratio between the lanthanides and the nickel-dominated ejector. I know in Dan's paper here, again, they have a few different possibilities for YEs and relative ratios. Is that just a theoretical exercise? Is it going to be completely dominated by lanthanides? And, or do people have any thoughts on what could make it more nickel-dominated and bluer?
So I do think that composition of the dynamically ejected material, tidal tails, stuff like that, is reasonably certain. I think the composition of the disk outflows is significantly more uncertain. I mean, the stuff that Rodrigo and Brian did is quite nice, but that's hydro simulations. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a fair amount of work to do there to better predict the actual composition of the disk outflows. And there's definitely work ongoing in that area.
And for that, the composition is important. But then I think that getting the amount right is probably, you know, we don't even know that yet. So that, I think, depending on how important the disk ejector is going to really, you know, is it 10 to the minus 4 or 10 to the minus 2, that's going to completely... Well, then you're like, yeah, getting the YE then is hard, but you can then envision it being higher, much higher in the disk win than it is in the title ejecta.
So I think that's a problem that a lot of people are working on, precisely.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, so any other comments on the fast blue emission?
Quite sensitively on the equation of state of a neutron star, because you know, it's the size of this object.
Right, the maximum mass question. Or do you mean something else?
No, like the velocity with which they collide and things like this depend quite sensitively. You know, if you have 15 kilometer neutron star, it will be very different from if you have 7 kilometer neutron star.
Okay, so can I once again humbly beg, plead the theorists to start thinking about this free neutron stuff in more detail? I mean, there's so many ideas in the room already, so it'd be great to see some more papers and simulations and predictions on free neutron, or just anything escaping relativistic speeds such that they have a bulletproof jacket against Chris Fryer's opacities. Okay, so on that note, let's go on to our third question. Which is a slow red light. This red light is, you know, as a function of time, is getting redder and redder. It's very depressing if you're an observer. I know earlier in this workshop, Chris showed his recent opacity results, which showed that the emission is actually a factor of 10 redder, factor of 10 fainter, and the peak is redder. So is this, has the going gotten so tough that we are all doomed? I mean, is it even worth doing I-band, Z-band searches to look for kilonova emission, such as the one with the dark energy camera, with PanSTARRS, with the many, many telescopes that Hypersupreme Cam that are trying to go deep and look for I-band, Z-band emission? But factor of 10 is 2.5 magnitudes, which is...
To me, there's a puzzling psychological state you're in. In the double black holes, there's, to first approximation, no theoretical.
Absolutely, right.
And yet, we're really confident you should go look, okay? And the double neutron stars, there's a tremendous diversity of theoretical work, all of which is worthy of doing. And you should be encouraged, not discouraged from doing it, from doing your observations.
Okay.
In fact,
I understand you have to decide what bandpass to look at. You should take it as guidance, right?
Okay.
If everybody else is doing I band, then maybe something, either for somebody else to do something other than I band.
To do G band? Okay. okay.
But I think what I was hearing from Elliot and others earlier is there's not consensus that Chris is right, so on anything. so this is a
no, but I think all.
So the issue is that disk ejecta is definitely has a good chance of being less neutron rich. So and so it will not be lanthanide dominated. The arguments we're having right now on the lanthanides is I think probably more how do you implement opacities and how do you calculate them, and so there it's a research area, so that it will change something, you know, that movement will also change. But I think the biggest differences right now are, am I getting some stuff that's not pure lanthanides getting ejected, because that makes it so that, you know, it's and so we that part definitely you should be looking, because we don't know what comes out after you've done the merger, so it's not just tidal ejecta.
Okay, so let's phrase this differently. In that, okay, let's say that suppose Chris turns out to be right. I think this is enough debated that people will look, right? I mean, there's a much stronger case here to look than for black hole mergers, as Lars pointed out. So people will go look, start placing limits. Hopefully these limits get deeper and deeper and more constraining. But if the opacities start getting redder and redder, then they're not as constraining. But is there any hope at all if for looking for very, very red emission, as in if the peak is entirely in the infrared, and actually, I mean, in the opacity plot that Chris showed, it was a factor of 10 in the infrared, but I think factor of, Chris, was it a factor of 100 in the optical?
Sorry?
Was the opacity difference like a factor of 100? Because I, your plot was something like that, right?
Yeah.
So is it a factor of, and it was a factor of 10 in the infrared bands,
yeah, it was a little bit
but
more
it was 100, or because it was a log scale on the Y.
Yeah, and that, remember, that was just how do you implement the opacities? What do you choose to how you, you calculate, well, what do you calculate for the opacities and how do you implement them? But yeah. Yeah, so one of them, I did this, one of them assumes the expansion capacity assumption is based on Sobolev, and it assumes that you're dominated by several strong lines, and you can treat those lines as scatterers because they immediately re-emit in the same wavelength. And then the fact that you have an expansion capacity actually makes it so that you can escape those lines quicker, so it actually lowers the opacity. The other problem is if you have a lot of lines and you're just going from one to another, you know, you're actually seeing just a broad band, it's a lot harder to calculate. Then you have to, instead of just calculating the strong lines, you have to calculate all the lines that are contributing, and then you get a more broad brush. And this is what we do for nuclear physics, is right, we get the total surface area. That's how they do most nuclear cross-sections. And then that opacity, the fact that you have expansions merges these lines, and so it makes it so they effectively merge, and you get a higher opacity. So that, and it's really then how, so you know the atomic physics, how do you implement it? And we're going to be, this is a problem not just in these in the kilonova or macronova, but it's going to be a problem in supernova. How are we implementing these opacities? And funnily enough, across we've been doing more and more code comparisons, and the way people are doing even supernova opacities, everyone has their own prescription to how they implement them. And so errors are going to happen even in those, probably smaller, but these are the, you know, it's just how do you decide the opacities are going to work.
Okay, but putting on my observer's hat again, if the optical is doomed, or if the limits are start to just say that these red opacities are right, then is there any hope at all in the infrared, right? And here I've sort of plotted our arsenals and the entire world's arsenal of infrared detectors. Now, infrared is a really, really hard place to look because, as Sri pointed out in the morning, that the per pixel cost is just over the roof. There's monopoly by one company, and it's just really, really, really expensive to build wide field infrared detectors. The widest field infrared detector is WorldCam on Vista, which is 0.6 square degrees. The second biggest is 0.16 square degrees, which is WFCAM on UKIRT, and everything else is 0.0 something. That's how bad the ground-based arsenal in the infrared is. In space, some things are happening, like Euclid, maybe WFIRST in the next decade. There's a proposal called ETA that Peter Shohan and others are working on, but that's also next decade. In the optical, and for comparison, there's, you know, going to be a 47 square degree camera, and there are many, many 10 square degree cameras, and some very big telescopes which have several square degree cameras. So the infrared is lagging very far behind the optical in terms of wide field imaging. So what is there any hope? Is the question, right? So I can tell you that not all is lost. I won't completely give up. But I won't bail out even if Chris is right. I'll continue this hunt for infrared events, because infrared, independent of LIGO, there's lots of fun things happening in the infrared. I did a really tiny search for just 200 nearby galaxies. This is like what optical was doing in the 1990s, looking at individual nearby galaxies with Spitzer, and I found a whole bunch of transients in this luminosity gap between novae and supernovae. So I think that there is hope in the infrared, and I have a dream, and I call it a dream because in this new job as an assistant professor, you're only supposed to call your ideas dreams until you get funding. So it's a dream right now. This is an idea that I've been working on with Anna Moore and Rob Simcoe, and actually two ideas here. One is to to build a, you know, 1-square-degree infrared camera for the 100-inch telescope at DuPont by using re-imaging and alternative semiconductors. If mercury-cadmium telluride is too expensive, let's try and use InGaAs. And these are cameras that are being developed for night vision, and Rob is testing them in his lab. And we are trying to convince Juna to see if this can be part of AS4 and some explorations there. So that way, I mean, you can go to a completely different type of silicon and still get reasonable pixel scale, reasonable sampling, and maybe get to the 1-square-degree regime on a 2.5-meter telescope, which could be quite cool. Another idea is to just give up on pixel scale completely. It's not, yeah, it'd be very comparable mapping speed as VISTA, but maybe more dedicated than VISTA because they're trying to decommission VISTA. Sorry? We'll cool it. It'll be YJH, but it'll be thermoelectric coolers, so it's much cheaper. So we're just trying to break the cost curve there because the difference per pixel cost difference is something like a factor of 4 in InGaAs versus mercury cadmium telluride. So that's how we can go to the sort of scale. I mean, VISTA is a very, very expensive instrument. This is, the cost of this is a factor of several smaller than VISTA. Or the other idea is to just bite the bullet and deal with coarse pixels. I mean, have an optical design and image subtraction software that can deal with large pixels. And this is an idea to build a 100-square-degree infrared camera on the South Pole. And if you go to the South Pole, the cool thing is that actually this plot on the top right, the night sky on the South Pole has a dip at 2.35 micron. This is called the K-dark bandpass. Here the sky is 50 times darker than any other temperate site on the Earth. Mauna Kea, your favorite Chilean site, whatever have you. So in this bandpass, right, I mean, what I'm showing here is actually Dan Kaysen's theoretical model for kilonovae. If Chris Fryer's ones are fainter and redder, and the peak is pushing you to the several micron, then maybe you have to go to one of the poles. I mean, South Pole, North Pole, one of the poles where the sky is intrinsically darker. Because that's the best you can do from the ground. The only other alternative is wait till the next decade and launch something into space.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing is mine is actually brighter than his, you know, in that bandpass. So
okay.
I would actually say it could be really bright there.
Right, right, exactly. So that would be a case to actually build this instrument and go hunting. And there are two problems, right? One is a detector cost and the other is a night sky. At least in night sky, you get a factor of 50 gain on the polar location in the specific bandpass. So that could be a way to make some progress here and not quit, if not be completely doomed if those opacities are indeed right. So WFIRST, I think, so I wrote a white paper for WFIRST and trying to see what sort of EM follow-up it could do. Now, next decade is a very different game, right? Because next decade, there should hopefully be 3 to 5 gravitational wave detectors, better localizations. So WFIRST will be very sensitive. So going into space is by far, you know, you get rid of the entire night sky problem entirely. So actually, WFIRST can go very deep in 10-square-degree areas. The biggest debate right now with the WFIRST team is whether they'll allow TOs, whether the data will come down quickly enough. They haven't been as supportive of proposals that will look into transient capability with WFIRST so far. But I hope, I mean, we are trying to convince them. We haven't yet convinced them to do TOs. Again, Euclid, I don't think they're open to TOs. And I have less of a European insight on who to try and convince to take over their telescope. So
they're scanning this guy.
So but they're not repeating fast enough. Yeah. I think it's months, and because they're just looking for deep exposure, so they're just trying to systematically scan and maximize scanning efficiency. So the idea with WFIRST was that in these same surveys, if you just reshuffle some of the tactics, that then you can get both cadence and do some time domain astronomy as a piggyback on the other surveys they've planned. But so far they haven't been convinced. But
so
I hope
there's something for the community, us, and
I guess, I mean, there's a whole bunch of, I don't know who the hardest person to convince there is, but the double first thing, this is. I think it's a science priority, so they don't want to, first of all, be interrupted in whatever they're doing. Second of all, they don't want to download the data and process it fast enough to look for transients. So, I mean, they had this call for, like, science team investigations, and we put in a proposal, but didn't fly. But we'll see. I mean, I think that... Oh, this was last. This was before February 11th. So, so maybe try again. Yeah, I mean, I think the best time to try again was when the first neutron sub black hole one is detected. But I can say, okay, just we have a couple more questions to go through. So one more thing I want to say on this note is that the one part of this dream that is becoming a reality very soon is that we have a test system, a 25 square degree J-band system that we're putting up at Palomar that we just got some funding for from the Mount Cuba Astronomical Foundation. So next year, we should have a 25 square degree and a little 30 centimeter telescope in J-band at Palomar. So we can start to look for infrared transients, and at least start to understand the dynamic infrared sky. This is you know, just a small step in the direction of these dreams, but not all is lost if the opacities are crazy. Okay, any other comments on opacities?
If the opacities are large, just to remind you, there are a lot of neutron star masses, there are a lot of possibilities of disks, they may not all be exactly the same. So I think, you know, even if the first five don't turn up in the G band, you shouldn't give up that the sixth one.
Okay, we'll try as long as the tax let us. Okay. Question four. So this came up in the morning a little bit. What exactly are the host galaxy properties of neutron star mergers? So this came up in the context of Searle's question, where he pointed out that the kicks are very small of the galactic neutron star binaries, but the observed distribution of galaxies from short-hard gamma ray bursts show large offsets and large kicks. Hostless, but the hostless is relative, right? Because the short-hard bursts discovered by SWIFT are all very far away. So even though Wen-Fei Fong's thesis work is beautiful and has HST limits on those locations, they're not probing a lot of the luminosity function of galaxies. So those limits, I think, are like minus 17, minus 16. Not high redshift galaxies, but could there be smaller dwarf galaxies underneath that location? Right, it's like minus 17, minus 16 level, I think, absolute magnitude. Okay, but in any case, I mean, I think now we live in the world of ultra faint dwarfs that are all the way down to globular clusters at minus 8, right? I mean, it's not even physically possible to get those limits for the lowest, even the lowest redshift short-hard gamma ray burst. But is there any reason to suspect that neutron star mergers could come from small galaxies? Some rather exotic transients like superluminous supernovae, long duration gamma ray bursts, preferentially come from little galaxies. Is there any reason to expect that neutron star mergers could come from little galaxies? Or some subset of them could prefer low metallicity environments? Or just a thought, because that would solve Searle's Kicks conundrum, right?
Black hole mergers in the predictions, if you give any belief in them, population synthesis will come from mostly from the low metallicity galaxies. But I don't think the trend is strong for the neutron.
But what about neutron star black hole?
That would favor
so little galaxies?
Except you want mass ratios for star black holes. Or to be interesting for EM, one to now be high mass ratios. My guess is
they're going to be small black holes.
No, yeah, it's not even so much an EM bias. It's just what will not LIGO see, right? I mean, in terms of LIGO will be sensitive to any sort of neutron star black hole. So, I mean, the EM implication is that there are several searches which are biasing themselves to the big, massive galaxies in the error circle. Is that a good thing to do or not? Right? Right, exactly. That's what Selma was pointing out, right?
I mean, it's also not crazy. I mean, in the Milky Way, the neutron star contribution from globular clusters is only a few percent. But we do know there is a double neutron star system that will merge in globular clusters. So some of them could intrinsically, you shouldn't necessarily concentrate just on the center of the bright galaxy.
Absolutely. I think drawing big 100 kiloparsec circles around galaxies, whatever their size. Absolutely.
Right.
Very small, right? These are tens of.
I mean, like the famous stuff of pulsar, the proper motion is less than 9 kilometers a second, and it's within 10 parsecs of the galactic plane. Right?
So my heat prediction would be that black holes
travel
less far than people.
But as the gravitational wave network evolves, this question changes, right? Because as you see deeper and you get better localizations, the pointed galaxy strategy, as Greg said this morning, becomes less effective because you're going out to 400-500 to gigaparsec distances.
With, and you just don't have galaxy catalogs at that distance at all, right? But I think this is more in the first few years where there is some hope of meaningful galaxy catalogs. What would this mean? But basically, I mean, I think this is just a slide. I think there was some interest in what this census of the local universe catalog was that Greg mentioned in his talk. So there's a postdoc at Caltech, Dave Cook, who's now working on building this galaxy catalog, which basically looks at the H-alpha emission line, but redshifted into four narrowband filters between redshift 0 and redshift 0.05, which is 200 megaparsec. And this is a 3-pi survey of the northern sky. And the idea is that the line shifts into one filter, but is not there in the other filter. So if you look at two images, you either see the galaxy in the on image, but you don't see the galaxy in the off image. And this little galaxy is actually a local galaxy. It's only 75 megaparsec, but completely missed by known catalogs. So there are a lot of such missing galaxies, and Dave Cook is about to release all the candidates that we have in the PTF H-alpha survey in the Sloan footprint in a month, which would be really exciting, because then now we can push the completeness of the catalogs now to much, much more interesting depths than before.
Just to make sure I understand, so it's in Sloan.
Yep.
But what do you mean it's missing? It's
There's no there. Spectrum. There's no spectrum. There are lots of galaxies. It's not. There's no redshift, known redshift. So when we say we discover a galaxy in the local universe, the images exist, right? But we just don't know it's a local galaxy or a background galaxy, because there's no spectrum. So this is sort of a poor man's spectrum, where we have four narrowband filters, and so now we know the redshift of the galaxy, and so we now know it's local. So it's now in our catalog, which we use when we are searching for counterparts, and we say, okay, now this is next to a nearby galaxy, let's go get a spectrum of this transient.
So what is
Sloan? Nothing, just called it a galaxy.
So do you know what fraction of spatially extended things in Sloan have redshifts?
Tiny. Sloan has spectra of things under 17 and a half mag or something. And here we're pushing on 19 mag. There are and many, 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 many fuzzy things are at much higher redshift.
What fraction of the star formation rate are in the galaxy when you look at the luminosity?
So I've not normalized it to star formation rate. I just know the B-band luminosity. But I think you have to convert that to star formation rate. So right now, these catalogs are at something like 50% at 200 megaparsec. And this would push it out to 85% in B-band luminosity terms. But that's in B-band luminosity, not in star formation rate units. So I think you have to do that conversion. Oh, there are actually. In fact, there was an even more embarrassing case where we found a supernova with PTF 10AXF, where we went and got a spectrum of the supernova, and it was at 20 megaparsec, and that was in an uncatalogued galaxy, and that galaxy was an arcminute in size. It just happened to be in the galactic plane. People knew it was a galaxy, but there's just no redshift of that galaxy. So even at 20 megaparsec, we are using supernovae which to find galaxies, which is just the wrong thing to do, but. So no, the galaxies definitely host. Yes. Yes. So Dave has 47 confirmed candidates. He just had a very good TBSP run in July, where two nights he just went through the candidates, all the candidates in one field, to find out how many of these things we're calling candidates are in fact nearby, and how many have some other line that's coming into the bandpass, and it's actually at higher redshift. He was able to confirm 47 out of, I think, 75 or something. So he's refining his criteria based on that.
Are
higher redshift galaxies. So it's like O3 line that comes in, and, or it's too close to the edge. Maybe the line axis was not real. So he's refining based on that. So this is all the candidates in one field that he did. Yeah, so the H-alpha, yeah, right, so the H-alpha equivalent width depth that we go to is 20 angstrom. So if you look at the Levenhag survey, this is actually, I mean, very, very, one of our test fields is in the coma cluster, and we're finding things there, which is a very red and dead environment, but we are finding H-alpha emitters there that, I mean, you need just a tiny, tiny bit of H-alpha for it to show up as an emitter in this map. Right. Any core collapse phenomena, that could be very interesting. You have a question? Or?
Yeah, so just to follow up on what Elliot said, so when you do the survey, are you looking for uncatalog stuff in slow and then following up, or are you basically just doing image differencing of H-alpha on H-alpha off?
Oh, so in the Sloan footprint, I mean, Sloan is very complete in terms of identifying things as galaxies. Right. So we are just looking at Sloan galaxies and seeing which ones have excess. So which ones could be local amongst them. So. No.
Well, they have a little bit of star formation in this galaxy. If you have black holes, then you're fine, so we're not successful with this thing. Maybe these other holes.
You mean for intermediate mass stuff?
I think the galaxies, I mean, science in general from this project is huge. I mean, there's a lot of things you can do with a more complete census of galaxies out to 200 megaparsec. I don't think we've even started to tread the edges of what all we can do with such a catalog beyond the simple use, practical use for transient science. Okay. Next question. So how creative is nature? I mean, this was something that came up in Sri's talk. Do short outbursts only represent a subset of neutron star, neutron star, and neutron star black hole mergers?
We only have Huh? Beyond the obvious beaming correction.
Beyond the beaming correction. Of course, there's the beaming correction, right? I mean,
there's neutral stir platform where maybe you don't, you know, form the disk at all, right? Because the neutral stir gets swallowed. Those aren't going to probably make short
records. Wait, sorry, can you repeat that?
But if a neutral star black hole, if the neutral star gets swallowed whole, there's nothing to cause a burst anyway, so.
Okay. 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 Let's make it. Okay.
It cross off neutral star black hole and ask the same question.
No.
Oh yeah. put up the diagram that Francois showed.
The question is also is from an EM point. Is there a range of EM phenomenology not associated with short arc?
Right. Are there some cases the jet just doesn't exist? It's not just that it's pointed away from you or something. The jet just doesn't exist. I mean, there is no short-hot gamma ray burst pointed away or towards you at all. For example...
So there's the too much baryon contamination. If it doesn't collapse to a black hole, then you might not imagine
So the dirty fireball. Right? The dirty fireball model is one. So, because
measuring the beam being live with seal,
so at the run, at the end of O2, I have a question, because one way to at least get some handle on this is what I consider as purely from LIGO, I'm very impressed with those limits already. I know they're high at 95% confidence level, but they're approaching an interesting regime. So at the end of this, the next run, what are the expected, let's say we find no neutron star black hole, or neutron star, black hole, how much would, is this just a linear increase in time, or maybe not this rate?
Yeah, it just scales, the rate's 1 over BT, right?
So that's what I was.
The sensitivity of LIGO is up, you get the Q, right, because it's V.
Two, and then we have observed for the same length or whatever. So V times T, okay, or whatever, V effective, okay. That's sort of a...
Well, it depends on the commissioning progress, right? Because if you look at those, the diagram that Greg showed us in my talk, the bands, right? Mm-hmm. So that's in VT relative to O1. So, like Danny was saying, you know, for O2A, we're not expecting much increase in sensitivity, right? So there you've just got T. But if you increase the sensitivity by a factor of 2, you get cubed that, right? Because it's V is cubed of the sensitivity. And so it's a commissioning dependent problem. So you get up to O3 sensitivity, and O3 is not even designed. Right, so O3 is not yet at design sensitivity, and that's taking a big bite out.
So that's a big deal thing for me, because 10 to the 4 per gigapascal cube per year is comfortably above 1,000, which is the best case beaming corrected thing. But if you guys go and don't find anything, and then you say it's 1,000, you're getting very interested.
I mean, the O1 results are beginning to kind of brush what will make people pay attention.
I think you have some trust in
when is that?
2017. Now it could, I mean, if the mystery nodes is tracked down after O2A, it could get interesting in O2B, right? I mean, the O2B results start. Yeah. Well, you get most of the sensitivity, even when neutral starts, you get most of the range from the frequency sensitivity. You always want to drive down the low frequency for everything. Because of the F line, the 7 thirds, right? You stack it all.
Okay, so do we have any bets on what fraction of neutron star, neutron star, neutron star black hole modules are short hot bursts and what fraction are not? So how many people say short hot bursts are less than 10%? Okay, less than 50%.
That's difficult because reasonable beaming has a factor of 2
No, no, I'm including the beamed and unbeamed, isn't it?
You have to either make beams are much broader than people would fit in the soft DRDs, or they're really long in the neutron solids, because otherwise the rate is about right.
Okay.
You have to, depending on the mass ratio of the
So the interesting thing is when you do make this ratio of rates, it might, you know, depending on what your model for how you make sure first you can probe the equation state. So if the fraction is 10% versus 90%, that would be, you learn something there. But I think it.
So this is the equation of state only in the sense of that tidal thing that the black hole.
He's thinking first.
Yeah, if I needed to collapse quickly to be a black hole to avoid baryon contamination, then I can use it as a, you know, that relative fraction I can use as a way to constrain the equation state, because then I know that the, you know, if the maximum mass for a neutron star is 3 solar masses, then they would all, you know, most of these systems are going to be neutron stars afterwards for a long time, they're going to have, and they'll be baryon contaminated, and I can say that most of them don't. If you worry about baryon contamination, like some people don't.
Sorry, I'm just about to. There are two separate things here. One is mass versus radius, maximum mass, and then the mass radius relation.
Yeah.
Okay, the maximum mass, we say, is 2.8. This is a completely within our grasp. We can do events, micro events, yeah, similar. No emission, yes, emission, okay, almost. But the mass of radius thing is a little bit more subtle.
So that one's harder. I mean, different places, it's different phenomenologies. So you have people create an equation state, and it makes a prediction, but you can do the phenomenological stuff that Andrew Steiner does, and then you can vary that mass radius relation in lots of different ways. So I can say I have a 2.8 solar mass vein, but I played with my free parameters for an equation state to get several answers. So I think measuring the mass radius relation, once you push above 2.5, they're going to a lot of phenomenological models anyway for the equation state. So you can get a wide range of answers. There are papers, yeah. So but the one that's kind of broader is maybe Steiner, but there will be a whole workshop on this next summer.
Okay, and then I added a sixth question because of something Elliot asked me at lunch, but I forgot to change the number, so I still say five. But just before we break here, the last question I had for you guys is, when we see it, will we believe it?
It doesn't matter, you'll publish it anyway.
So I think the point of this question really was, caution is a better part of valor here, right? I mean, we think we know what we're looking for, but it could be red, it could be fast, it could be temporally coincident, it could even be next to a nearby galaxy, but be completely unrelated.
This is a LIGO problem, they'll believe anything, they're desperate.
So I think we know. So we know, I mean, the transient sky is so rich that I think we know of examples of each of the above, and some pretty painful examples of each of the above, where some of these things or some subset of these things was true, but it was not related to the gravitational wave trigger. I won't go into those examples. I think they'll break some hearts. But I mean, I could start talking about the Fermi discovery and then also say that they found something even with the false positive trigger, G194575. And then there was a debate, and then it's even not true whether they saw something at all, let alone whether it was related to the black hole merger or not, right? I mean, so. But there's a series of theory papers that explain it or try to explain it. That's one, right? I mean, we've seen some really fast fading. We saw a red signal in Marcel's presentation, right? Which was just a normal type 2P falling off the plateau. Nothing deep there, but it was red. It looked like it was fast. It was even near a nearby galaxy, but had nothing to do with that event, right? With I mean, right now there isn't much, right? There's a superluminous supernova. There's all kinds of other unrelated interesting events. But I think the most painful ones are the ones that look like it, right? I mean, so for example, look, even the one that's heralded as the most obvious, you know, kilonova detection, GRB 1306O3b. I know Sri didn't want to comment on the nature of that one, but I don't believe it. I think Elliot doesn't believe it either, because we saw red X's. But at the same time, and there's a paper by a very nice paper by Wen-Fei Fong where she shows us there's also an X-ray axis. And I think kilonova models struggle very, very much to explain both an infrared and an X-ray axis at that time. So even though we think we've seen a kilonova, that one is supposedly our one example kilonova, I think it's not.
So now you've made me sad because I had this argument with Vito, could it be something else? And he goes, oh, no. Because I was predicting something, but I would have had more X-ray. Where's the X-ray? And now you're telling me there is X-ray.
Oh, there is X-ray. Yeah. In fact, that paper was published. There was a paper by Wen-Fei Fong just 3 months after the GRB, which showed that there's X-ray. But that's a much lesser known paper, because I think it makes the kilonova story a little bit more challenging.
Although
It's still surprising there's no optical. So I mean, it seems the central engine is on. It's really. I mean, but my point is, it's not obvious at all that this thing was a kilonova. So.
The trouble with Edo's object is it's a one-point light curve, and
right.
I think 5-point light curves are probably, especially if you have the week before and the week after, a lot of your supernovae falling off, a lot of it's in a matter of context, right? If it's a 1-point light curve, it would be much less than this.
Right, and.
5-point light curve.
Well, you
have that. I mean, is there any hope to get a nearby short GRB and take a spectrum in the IR of these IR bombs?
Of a nearby short GRB, I don't know about a nearby short GRB, but for a nearby LIGO signal, again, if there is enough of a blue emission.
You're triggering in the short GRB, you get a red excess.
Right, because the rates of anything close enough for it to be bright enough for spectroscopy is this small. No, but it's just even though it was too far.
The
Right. So basically, my point is that models are great, but we should do our homework and caution's a better part of valor here. So I think with that, we're ready for cookies. Right.